In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm honored and pleased to have you spend a little time with us as we keep an eye on big government. The news this past week has been all about Governor Kitzhaber's sudden resignation, after previously saying that he would and then he would not resign. But when news broke about him trying to destroy emails, it was really just a matter of time. Within hours after his resignation, the FBI issued a subpoena, and this immediately crossed from a state investigation about ethics to a federal investigation. The subpoena targets 15 individuals and multiple state agencies. Now that all this has broke, we want to understand not only the process the FBI goes through to obtain a subpoena in the first place, but how they build their case and just how far all of this will go. So we set out to find someone in the FBI who has a depth of experience prosecuting racketeering and investigating public corruption. On today's show, you'll get an inside look at the process of discovery, the business and personal relationships that the FBI will likely dig into, and whether associates of the former governor and Sylvie Hayes should be worried. And to talk about all this, I'd like to welcome Chris Mazzella. He's an attorney and former FBI agent. He has over 34 years experience working throughout the United States. And while in the FBI, he was the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force coordinator for the Florida Caribbean area. He was a legal counsel, media representative, and public corruption supervisor. And most recently, he retired as the Inspector General for Miami-Dade County in Florida. Chris, it's an honor to talk to you today.
It's great being on your show.
So I've already kind of given people a thumbnail sketch of your background with the FBI. Did I miss any highlights there? Would you like to kind of let people know a little bit more about you?
Well, 34 years really flies by. it was quite a career. It's a kind of job that every person dreams of. And, you know, you learn an awful lot as you go along in a position like that. And I certainly can only attribute any of my successes to the people who work around you. So I think the main thing, the main experience I had with the FBI and delving into difficult corruption cases is the fact that we always had a great diversified number of people working a case from all different walks of life and all bringing their own experience and background to these investigations. That's what makes the Bureau so great.
Well, we want to talk to you today to get a better understanding of what it takes to prosecute a public official. As everybody knows out here in Oregon, our governor has just resigned. In fact, that happened on Wednesday. And we now have a new sitting governor. But so what does it take really to prosecute a public official? Is going after a public official substantially different from prosecuting somebody in the private sector?
Well, absolutely. We have to recognize that public officials have a special position in our society. And so whenever a public official is alleged to have done something inappropriate or wrong, whether it's taking money or stealing a car, we tend to scrutinize those cases a lot more carefully because there's always the potential accusation that the investigation is politically motivated, either by the person providing information or by the government itself in prosecuting it. So, in a few short sentences here, we do always pay closer attention to the subject of the investigation, particularly where the subject is a public official.
Well, I think some people looking at the Oregon governor scandal might think, "Well, so what? You know, isn't this just par for the course? And this is just how the system works. They go in, they gain notoriety, and this prestige then translates to bigger and better paychecks." But at what point does someone gaining political power cross the line into becoming criminal activity?
Well, I think, you know, when they discard the public trust that the voters imbued them with, then we cross the line. You know, we elect our public officials with the expectation and hope that they will do an honest job and that the taxpayers will receive services that we expect them to render. And so when public officials abuse their power, whether it be in the form of taking money or doing favors or gaining some other benefit, then we need to stop that type of activity because it just corrupts the entire governmental system.
So, but in terms of it becoming a criminal activity, for example, and you talked about them taking money and wielding influence and whatnot. For example, lobbyists influence politicians all the time. Why is that not illegal, but influence peddling by the governor or first lady is illegal?
Well, lobbyists, and you're right, these are difficult things to delve into, but you know, the whole theory is that lobbyists are individuals that do their job in a form of educating the government, educating particular officials about what products or services their company can render. And so they serve a function in bringing to light things that would otherwise not be understood or known to a government official, to help them make a decision in awarding contracts to private companies. And in a sense, yes, they are influencing government officials through their arguments. And that should be the way it is. But, you know, when public officials then receive certain benefits from the lobbyist, you know, they're just not doing their job, and then that's where the corruption arises, where something is offered that would otherwise not be available in the form of a benefit or a payoff or whatever that might be. Then we've crossed the line of honest interaction.
Well, and in terms of the Kitzhaber case, what types of charges are likely to be brought? Does this fall under the category of racketeering or fraud or corruption? What legal pigeonhole does this fit into?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm not familiar with all the details of,
sure,
of that case. But, in generality, I think, you know, as my experience has shown, where public officials derive a benefit from, you know, from an interaction or transaction. Generally speaking, those might fit into general bribery statutes.
I see.
Or racketeering statutes, where the federal government would prosecute under the racketeering statutes that are available. They could involve money laundering. They could involve mail fraud or wire fraud. Or any number of collateral statutes that might cover that type of activity.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and take a break right here. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Chris Mazzella. He's an attorney and former FBI agent, and we will be coming back with a little bit of psychoanalysis. Stay with us. And welcome back. Thanks for staying with us. This is the I Spy Radio Show. Talking today to Chris Mazzella. He's a former FBI agent, and among his many roles with the FBI, he was with the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force Coordinator and also a public corruption supervisor. And we're talking about the Kitzhaber scandal and how that is going to unfold. And in this segment, I'd like to get kind of a little bit of psychoanalysis. And in your experience, are there certain personality types that tend to be more prone to commit these types of crimes?
Wow. I mean, I think I've seen just about every type of personality get involved with corruption cases in one form or another. I mean, you can look at corruption not only, you know, at executive levels that you're talking about today, but you know, throughout government, from its lowest ranks right up through the most powerful people in government, you're going to find corruption. Generally, you know, it could involve anything from taking money to not doing your job and costing the government millions of dollars for, because of laziness or failure to exercise your duties.
And you know, if we prosecuted everybody in government that was guilty of incompetence, I don't think there'd be anybody left.
Well, there's a lot of ways you could take care of incompetence without prosecuting them.
We'd like to think so.
I have to tell you, some people, when I was the Inspector General of Miami-Dade County, would often ask me what I thought corruption was. And my point I always made was, you know, corruption with respect to criminal prosecution is only maybe 5% of the big problem. Most of the money that we all lose in government today is because of inefficiencies and lack of oversight and failure for failure of individuals in the government to take care of the taxpayers' money. And I've always thought that to be a good form of corruption as well.
Oh, absolutely.
But, you know,
good
as far
point.
As personalities, these could include you know, people that are just prone to want to get things that they think they deserve. I don't think we see that many of them, but they do pop up, and these are the individuals that just think they deserve it all. And you know, once they get into a position where they can convert that to a benefit, or to convert that to their benefit, they're going to take every advantage to do it. And you know, where I always saw the trigger point was where public officials would resist oversight, where they just kind of want to shy away from it, where they lack the interest in supporting a strong oversight entity within their own.
That's really interesting, because we have seen that time and time again on this show. We've investigated a lot of environmental issues, and certainly with the healthcare situation here in Oregon, not just Cover Oregon, but I think really the more important story is the coordinated care organizations. And it's interesting that you go to the fact that they just don't like oversight. And we've seen that in both of those cases, both with the environmental issues and with healthcare issues, in the sense that when it came to the environmental issues down in the Klamath Falls area, they had they were trying to take out these dams on the Klamath River. And so they set up these so-called public forums, but you couldn't get into them. And if you did get into them, you had to sign a non-disclosure agreement saying that you wouldn't talk about anything that was said, but you had to agree to the outcome of the meeting before you even went in. These so-called public meetings were anything but public. They kept out public officials. They kept out members of the press. It was very closed door, and yet they then in the press they said, "Oh yeah, it's all these public meetings, and they had this consensus and all this, so on and so forth." And then the same thing with when they pushed through the coordinated care organizations here in Oregon, which is they have set up a number of these as private business entities, which means that you've got all of the power and influence of government, but you've got all of the privacy protections of a private business. And so, again, those meetings were sealed off from the public. And very few people were actually involved in that. It was all government officials, and they just didn't want that oversight. So listening to you, I'm suspicious that we're going to be seeing even more things coming out of these investigations. That's really interesting that you went there. In terms of, though, I guess we're talking about the people that are involved in this. As their power grows, are they more prone to these kinds of issues, or is it a matter of experience and they're less prone? What do you typically see?
My sense is, once you tasted the money, you're always going to go back to the well to taste a little more, and it just expands and proliferates. I've never actually seen a public official stop at just taking so much. You know,
wow.
They just keep going back to the trough. But, you know, to go back to your other point, and I just take a moment to say this, One thing I learned when I retired from the FBI and I went over and became the first Inspector General of Miami-Dade County, that it is such an important mechanism to have an independent, autonomous Inspector General within the government proper to be there to conduct oversight, to audit, to review programs and projects, and to prosecute criminal wrongdoing. I don't know if that is, in fact, something that the, aside from the Attorney General's office, but I don't know if that there is such an entity within Oregon state government or local governments. But Florida has really taken the ball here and run with it. They've begun opening many Inspector General's offices locally and throughout the state. So I think that is certainly one of the things that would probably want to come out of all of the problems that you're seeing now is the creation of such an entity within the state of Florida.
Yes, that would be very good to have. I honestly don't know that either. I know that we have some sort of reviews, but I think coming out of this, that may be one of the reforms that they look at pushing through. All right, we are up against the clock here. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Chris Mazzella, former public corruption supervisor with the FBI, and we're going to take a closer look at the inner workings of investigations. And welcome back. Thanks for staying with us on the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking about the Kitzhaber investigation, and to do that, we are talking with Chris Mazzella. He's a former public corruption supervisor with the FBI, and so in terms of what launches an investigation of public officials in the first place, is it typically a result of whistleblowers, newspaper reporting, officially filed complaints, or is there a federal and state watchdog agencies that is always on the lookout for these kinds of things?
Well, it's probably all of those and more. We basically are always amenable to accepting information from the public. Sometimes we would have sources of information available. Newspaper articles are always an important source, whistleblowers, particularly where you have a very strong whistleblower statute protecting individuals who provide information, and probably as I mentioned, at least in our neck of the woods, the Inspector General's offices provide. That are within government. I mean, this is why I think it's so important that you have those entities that are actually on the inside looking out often come across information that would tend to indicate there's criminality afoot. I always like to read audit reports put out by various entities to kind of identify weaknesses and areas that might be prone to corruption. Those are always important.
So it sounds like then you're looking at these kinds of audits with sort of a forensics kind of eye. Is that correct?
Very definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of information in these things that that would be certainly relevant to criminal investigation.
So, and I think one of the questions that is on a lot of people's minds is, why did this happen now as opposed to prior to the election? And I know you can't answer that, but do you think that there was probably a red flag to launch, just like, for example, the revelation that he tried to destroy emails? Was there a red flag that suddenly got the attention of the FBI because the allegations had been out there, like I said, for about 4 or 5 months prior to the subpoena?
Yeah, and I'm again, as I mentioned earlier, I don't know the details of the investigation, but my sense would be that the FBI had already been aware of that information, was probably going through its mechanism of or processes to open up an investigation, and and proceeded with due regard to those processes before it launched its official investigation. So my sense is they probably were aware of it already and then, you know, became more proactive in approaching it.
Hmm. Well, certainly looking at the depth and breadth of the subpoena, and we do have a copy of that. We'll make sure that we put that up on iSpyRadio.com for people to look at for themselves. It certainly does look like there is a lot of depth there in terms of they were probably already working on this. And so I would suspect that simply because it was released within hours of his resignation, I don't necessarily see that as worrisome or that there was any kind of political motive there. But in terms of putting those cases together, the subpoenas, I mean, if somebody wants to allege that, well, you know, he resigned and they were getting ready to drop the hammer there, how quickly is something like that put together? I mean, is that a matter of hours that they can pull something together like that? Or is that something that's going to take, you know, a few weeks or months to even pull together?
Well, first of all, understand that we talked about this earlier, that public corruption investigations are usually sensitive investigations, and
sure.
And so they are treated differently in the way government responds to the allegation of wrongdoing. I would venture to say that before a subpoena was even issued in this case, there were levels of approval that had to be obtained both at the Department of Justice and at FBI headquarters that would authorize the opening of an investigation, and those are not lightly authorized. I can tell you, you know, you've got to really provide a very strong, articulable facts that an allegation has some substance to it before it would be opened. And then, the type of investigative techniques that are going to be used to resolve the allegations would certainly have to be reviewed carefully. Obtaining a grand jury subpoena is no small matter. It does take some time to put these subpoenas together. Before you issue a subpoena, you got to have a pretty good idea of what you're looking for and where you're going to find it. And certainly, you would not issue a subpoena without a very good idea of where that information is going to be located or in what form it's going to come. Then you go to a grand jury. They authorize the issuance of the subpoena itself, and a judge, is reviewing all of this as you go along the process. So you can't get it in a couple of hours. It's not something that you kind of think, well, let's just put out a subpoena and maybe the public official will resign or we can put pressure on the witnesses to come forward.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting to hear you say that because I think some people were alleging some sort of suspicions there. But it's really interesting to hear you say that because if he had chosen not to resign on that particular day, he certainly would have probably the following day when they issued that subpoena. All right, everyone stay with us. We're up against the clock here. We're going to have more with Chris Mazzella, the FBI. Stay with us. And welcome back. We are talking about the Kitzhaber investigation here in Oregon. And to do that, we are talking with Chris Mazzella, former public corruption supervisor with the FBI. And so going into the break, we were talking about the nuances, really, of issuing these kinds of subpoenas. And you brought up an interesting point is the fact that they've got to be very careful when they issue these things because on the flip side of things, they could be actually accused themselves of manipulating an election. Like, for example, if they had done this right before the election, you know, the FBI is investigating the governor, you can imagine the impact that would have. So what level of burden of proof do they have to have before they finally feel comfortable moving forward with something?
And that's a good point. The level of information substantiating the allegation would have to be very strong, first of all, before you even embark on a public corruption case. As I mentioned, there has to be a very strong and articulable facts to substantiate the opening of the investigation. But also, where information might become public, certainly with the issuances of a subpoena, for example, the government would be very careful not to issue that type of investigative technique, such as a subpoena or a grand jury subpoena, that is, where it could impact the results of an election. That's always a very, very important consideration, because, you know, the government doesn't want to get in there and be accused of politicizing the investigation.
Well, now, on the flip side of that, let's say that they had all of this information immediately prior to the election. On the other side of things, shouldn't they have released this so that the public knew about these charges? What would you say to that?
I would say that would certainly be idealistic, but not very practical. And, you know, they could be doing a lot of other things at the same time without alerting the public to the fact that there is an investigation. There's nothing to say that the FBI hasn't been doing other work as it looks at this particular case, or any other case for that matter. But it's the impact of making it a public, making it public knowledge that that is most crucial.
So let's talk a little bit about the investigative process and what goes into the subpoenas. And I know that you can't comment on the specifics of this case, but when a subpoena is issued, does that represent basically the full extent of the information request? For example, in this particular subpoena, they're asking for information about a company called 3E Strategies, and they want everything since 2009. But the problem is in 2009, 3E Strategies changed its names to the Green Economy Institute. So does that mean state agencies won't even turn over records pertaining to the Green Economy Institute, or are they going to be looking just for 3E Strategies?
I think those issues would be negotiated, certainly between the United States Attorney's Office and the entities involved. I don't see that as a significant point. And the extent and breadth of the subpoena is just the surface. There could be other subpoenas issued for other companies, that is, in the private sector, not so much subpoena. The subpoenas, I understand, was directed to the state agencies.
Yes.
But there could be subpoenas out there now for the records of corporations. Individuals, bank accounts, there's a whole slew of information that may also be the subject of the investigation.
So this subpoena that was issued just this week, that's really kind of more the starting point, and it sounds like there's going to be multiple other subpoenas that then stem out from that. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable thing. And I wouldn't even call the subpoena the starting point. As I said, I'm sure there's been a lot of other activity, investigative activity already underfoot. I think you would see an expansion of those types of record requests being made by the government.
And this particular subpoena does not specifically request information from or to Sylvia's partners at that Green Economy Institute. But it sounds like, though, that these may be ongoing subpoenas or just ones that haven't been issued yet. Is that correct? Let me give you, for instance, let's say that a state agency has been working with Sylvia sort of through a backdoor means where they send emails to one of Sylvia's partners who then passes it on to Sylvia. Does this escape that attention so that they're looking just between Sylvia and that particular state agency, or is all of this going to eventually come under the purview of the FBI?
Again, not knowing the extent and breadth of all of this, my experience is that we always seek to expand the playing field where we think that evidence of a crime might be found. And so I can only say that you know, I think you can expect to see a lot more of these subpoenas.
We're getting close to break. Let's go ahead and take that now. Give us a little more time in the next segment. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Chris Mazzella. He's the former public corruption supervisor and also inspector general for Miami-Dade County. Stay with us. More on the Kitzhaber investigation after this. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today to Chris Mazzella. He is a former public corruption supervisor with the FBI, spent 34 years with them. And we are talking about the Kitzhaber investigation and getting a little better handle on the subpoena investigative process. And going into the break there, we're talking about the subpoenas and how far this net would go. When they start investigating private companies instead of state agencies, do they release that information to the public, or is that just not done because it's a private entity?
You have to understand that the grand jury is a secret process. And so information obtained as a result of grand jury subpoenas is not available for public consumption. You know, at the time it's collected, eventually it will be, but that usually isn't the case until we get into the pre-trial period. So the fact that even a subpoena was issued, unless the person receiving it acknowledges that, should not ever be disclosed by the government.
Interesting.
And it is a crime to disclose it. So it is a very important process to protect, again, the potential defendants in the case.
Well, so then why do you suspect that this one was a leak to the press, this particular subpoena? Was it because it was a state agency?
Probably. I'm sure nobody in the government leaked it. But, you know, once it's out there, it's like anything else. If you have good reporters, they'll be able to find it.
Yeah. So in terms of the investigative process, how many degrees of separation does the FBI investigate? For example, let me give you a scenario here. A Russian billionaire wants to hamper fracking processes in North Dakota. He donates $10 million to an organization called Friends of This and That. And so the Friends of This and That then help fund these green initiatives that take that $10 million and disperses it to, say, 10 groups. All of those organizations then work on a common goal to stop fracking, cause public awareness, release anti-fracking movies, and so on. One of those organizations hires Sylvia Hayes as a consultant. She then works with a state agency to develop anti-fracking policies. So given that scenario, are any one of those other organizations, those other nine organizations targeted? What about the umbrella organization, the Friends of This and That, and what about that Russian billionaire? And do they also then investigate that state agency?
If it were me, I probably would. My sense is, you know, you follow the money. That's always been
But at what point, though, do you stop following the money?
Stop following the money until you put it in the pocket of the corrupt official. That's where the money eventually goes, and that's where your investigation proceeds. In all of these scenarios, there was probably criminal intent of some sort, and getting that money to the right people to stop. Or to provide or promote a particular policy. And so there's probably culpability right up the line. My sense would be any one of those individuals involved in the transactions that got the money or benefit to the person who's targeted it, all of those individuals would be part of a conspiracy.
Interesting. So in terms of the actual criminal charges, in most cases, what does the FBI have to secure as actual evidence before criminal charges can be filed? Is it checks being cut? I mean, is it emails? I mean, what constitutes criminal activity then? Or the evidence thereof, I mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, the evidence could be extremely broad. Certainly, you'd want to get into the financial records. You'd want to see where the money was generated, who received benefits by way of these transactions. Certainly you want to look at email trails. I mean, sometimes those are as good as a search warrant. We found it's an amazing what people say in emails. It's just astounding. That certainly is going to be important. I would think the actual contracts, the consulting contracts that were obtained, and any contracts that the government issued will be germane. There's going to be many, many hundreds of interviews of public officials and state employees and people in the private sector to explain their actions and what they did and why they did it. It's a real big field out there, and the evidence could come from many, many different sources.
And what about when there isn't a document of some sort, whether it's a contract or an email or something like that? I mean, what happens when you've got a situation where there's kind of a handshake deal made over lunch where one person agrees to do whatever in exchange for whatever? Or especially if they handle it with cash. What do you do in that situation?
Well, that's where the cases have difficult times sometimes penetrating that type of transaction. I always found that in many cases we get around that because there is an evidence trail to lead to the conclusions that there was a criminal act. Sometimes you can't get it all. You just do what you can. But, the government's going to look at this from many, many different angles, not to mention the possibility of some tax issues if those present themselves as well. So
interesting.
It's really too early to tell. It really is. But I would suspect that the evidence is going to be very, very cumulative.
Well, and certainly as we've looked at some of these green groups, I mean, it just goes in all directions. It's like a whole bunch of rabbit trails going in all different directions. All right, everyone stay with us. We're going to be going into our final segment. We're going to be talking about some issues of jurisdiction. And then if people know something, what can you do about it? And thanks for staying with us. This is the iSpy Radio Show, talking about the Kitzhaber investigation here in Oregon and his resignation. And to do all that, we are talking with Chris Mazzella. He's a former FBI agent, and he was a public corruption supervisor there in Florida. And so, Chris, just a real quick question about jurisdiction. You've got the state agencies looking at this, and then you also have the FBI looking at this. Talk to us a little bit about that interaction, and for example, what happens if there's, I mean, first of all, is there a firewall between those two jurisdictions? Do they share information if one uncovers something that the other one doesn't have? And then also, what happens if one jurisdiction decides to file charges and the other does not?
All very, very complex questions. And I guess that's the democratic system we have. There should be as coordinated an effort as possible. There are some firewalls, unfortunately, that sometimes make it more difficult. For example, as I mentioned before, the fact that the grand jury has issued a subpoena now, in order for other agencies to share any of that grand jury information, they would all have to be cross-designated, or at least the investigator involved would have to be cross-designated with the federal government so that they can receive information. But of course, then that information is protected by grand jury secrecy laws. So to the extent that other agencies would be involved with the FBI in this case, they would certainly have to become part of what would be a federal task force, in effect, to make sure grand jury secrecy laws are not infringed. But besides that, other areas of the investigation certainly could be coordinated. I recall, you know, as the Inspector General of Miami-Dade County, we worked very closely with the FBI in a number of cases. And even though a grand jury had been convened, we were still able to participate in providing information about state or county contracts and county programs that were under investigation. So there is certain areas that we can still participate in. More or less, though, everything is potentially anything, any kind of criminal wrongdoing within a state is certainly going to be a violation of state law and, in most cases, federal law. You know, you can't say, well, the FBI is investigating, so nobody else should, or the Attorney General's office has got the case, and, you know, your agency should stay out of it. I don't think we find those situations anymore, or at least prevalent anymore in law enforcement.
So we've only got a couple minutes here with you. Real quick, if somebody knows something and they don't come forward, are they liable?
It all depends. I would say, generally speaking, if somebody knows something, they would certainly want to make it known or provide that information to the government. But there is no compulsion, no way to force someone to reveal information if they don't want to, unless you know, they're granted immunity in a legal process and compelled to testify. We hope that that usually is not always the case, but sometimes that happens. But if they do want to provide information, as I mentioned, there are protections in most states under whistleblower statutes where they're a person identified within the whistleblower statute as deserving or entitled to protection.
So, and I've only got about a minute here, and I want to get this in real quick, because we've got some amateur sleuths out there in our listening audience. If people suspect some things, or if they have information they think would be pertinent to the case, is that sort of investigation welcomed by the FBI, and who would they give that to?
They would probably want to contact the local field office of the FBI in Oregon, the state capital, and provide that information to the FBI directly. That would be my recommendation, enable the Bureau plus the other agencies involved to react to the information. Okay. You never know where you're going to find that kernel of gold.
That little gold nugget. Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Fascinating discussion, and it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out.
Well, thank you for inviting me onto your program, and all I can say is keep up the good work.
All right, thank you. Again, that was Chris Mazzella, former prosecutor and an agent for the FBI in their public corruption sectors. We'll definitely be following up with him as this continues to unfold. Before we go, I'd like to mention the organization that graciously put us in touch with him, which was the Society of Former Special Agents of the FBI Incorporated. Their website is socxfbi.org if you'd like to find out more about them. And if you missed that, well, of course, we'll put that up on our own website, iSpyRadio.com. Before we go, we know a lot of our listeners are also keeping an eye on big government every bit as much as we are here at iSpy. I would encourage you that if you know something, now is definitely the time to come forward with it and to let the FBI know what you know. Here at iSpy, we'll certainly be sending our own letter to the local field office, but just know that your tip could make a real difference and take them in a direction that they hadn't even considered yet. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.